even though I don't have my briefs yet, we'll proceed ahead. First case of the morning be Michael Vallone versus CNA Financial. Nickenberg.
May it please the court. Good morning to you all. My name is Bill Schneckenberg. I represent the appellant, Joyce Seideman, Michael Vallone, and James O'Keefe. This is an ERISA case. Started out as filed as a putative class action case on behalf of 347 retirees from the Continental Insurance Company. Judge Moran handled it below, entered summary judgments on all counts, and that's why we're here today. In addition, we're challenging Judge Moran's ruling that discovery on the contractual issues in this ERISA claim were limited to the administrative record. We're asking this court to reverse the summary judgments and to remand this case back to the circuit court for full discovery on the contractual issues along with any other issues that may arise. As I mentioned, there are essentially two types of claims being asserted by the plaintiffs in this case, the contractual claims and then the breach of fiduciary duty claim. The key question, the factual question that I believe exists with respect to the contractual claims, rests on the premise that based upon the way that this particular special retirement program was marketed to the employees, the documents they were given explaining it, along with the plan documents, which gave the employer the right to terminate health care benefits at any time, created an ambiguity that should have been resolved by a trier of fact rather than as a question of law.
Mr. Schneckenberg, with respect to the breach of fiduciary duty claim, what evidence is there that these misstatements about the health care allowance being a lifetime benefit were purposeful rather than negligent?
I think the best evidence to that effect is that management's knowledge that the benefits could be terminated. Maria Curatolo, who was the plan administrator on the 1990 plan, testified that employees should have been made aware that this was a plan, the health care allowance was a plan that could be terminated. At the same time, she indicated that no one had authority at the same time to tell employees that they had the right to lifetime benefits under the health care allowance. We then have the deposition testimony of Robert Marsh Fabardi, who is an employee from the East Coast that attended two large meetings of employees out there, one which was chaired by the same Maria Curatolo. In that meeting, these employees were all told that the health care allowance was to be a lifetime benefit. This is before the same person who is saying, oh yeah, they should have been told, but we didn't tell them. And in fact, no one had authority to tell them. And then in a meeting that she's chairing, all of these employees are being told that this is a lifetime benefit. And this wasn't simply a limited visit to this issue. This went to extremes across the country. We've introduced 23 affidavits from ex-employees from 13 different states who human resource management told this was a lifetime benefit. We have introduced the testimony of Mr. Marsh Fabardi, who appeared at two meetings on the East Coast. 75 to 100 people were present, and they were all told that this was a lifetime benefit. When management knew that it was not.
So it's your argument that would be the evidence that Continental meant to lure the employees into retiring, but in actuality had the intent to take the benefits away later. Is that what you're saying?
I can't. They had the right to do that. Did they have the intent at the time they made this? There's no evidence in the record that they had that intent. There's no evidence in the record that they intended to give these benefits as they said they did back in 1991. What I'm saying to the court is, and this is where Judge Moran...
Forgive me for interrupting, but I mean, what about our Fram opinion?
Fram.
Yeah.
That's the one that Judge Moran relied upon in,
right,
in granting the summary judgment. I think it is very distinguishable from this case, and this is why. In Fram, there was no campaign of disinformation. There was in this case.
Was this campaign because people were sent out to mislead, to say this was permanent when it wasn't?
I think it was. I think it was done for purposes of enticing a greater response to the need to retire employees and cut costs by Continental at that time and place.
Well, they were trying to sell a program, so I suppose they're emphasizing the positive and not saying a whole lot about the negative.
I'd say that was a good, that's the right statement, Your Honor.
So, in other words, now you are saying that they intended to terminate the Health Care Alliance at some point. That allowance at some time, notwithstanding the fact that they were stating that the Health Care Alliance was a lifetime benefit. I mean,
of course, that's excuse me. Lifetime benefit is ambiguous, isn't it?
Not when you provide written documentation to the employees that calculate their benefits on the basis of $465 per month till age 65, $100-some-odd per month thereafter, and if you survive, when you die, your wife will have a survival benefit. That seems to me to just reinforce the oral representation that's being made.
Well, as presented, as of now, this is what you're getting, but they claim that they reserve the right to change that at some later date. Now, the reality here isn't it that nobody ever abolished these health care benefits until the middle 90s when the cost started to go through the roof.
Right.
Then everybody started doing it, or not a lot of people did it anyway. So I'm not sure that back in 91 they were thinking a whole lot, or 92 they were thinking a whole lot about this matter. Isn't that a fair surmise?
I think historically Your Honor's right, but my beef with the way this was handled and why I think summary judgment was improper on the fiduciary duty claim is because I believe, and this circuit has addressed this issue, and this is one of these cases where I think you should. What is the duty to inform? How broad is that duty in this circuit? We know that employers can't misinform, but don't they have a duty to affirmatively to inform when the administrator knows that silence may be harmful? That is what happened here.
Was it premeditated that this merger was going to take place?
I'm sure. At the time that this program was, there's no evidence one way or the other on that.
It seems that does change the equation substantially. If once this merger occurs, and this was in place for 7 years, right?
Correct.
So anybody who was 55 at the time would be 62 at the time it was canceled. I don't know whether that makes any difference or not, but it does seem that there was, at least they were put into where they would have been. I don't know anything about the figures, and no one discussed that, but I just saw coincidentally the 7 years did bring the youngest people to age 62.
I've never even looked at that aspect of it.
I know. No one mentioned it. I just noticed it.
Mr. Sneckenberg, forgive me. I don't want to beat a dead horse, but it's terribly important that I understand your argument. Our opinion in Fram emphasizes that the fiduciary duty is a duty of loyalty as opposed to a duty of care. Is there evidence that Continental's management had a malevolent motive in making these alleged misstatements? In other words, that they really intended to terminate the HCA at some time, notwithstanding their statements that the HCA was a lifetime benefit?
I think that's the question of fact for the trier of fact. There is circumstantial evidence that suggests that they made these statements to accentuate a positive that they knew could be terminated at their option at any point in time to entice employees to retire. I have no crystal ball. There is no evidence in this case that gets into the minds of these people with respect to what they were thinking. But I can say without a doubt that the evidence does support the concept that they told these people a statement that was misleading when they knew they should have provided information that was more accurate, and they had a motive for misleading. That is, increase the number of retirements.
What about the written documents that the various, I guess the, whatever they call the summary, referred them to, the 1990 and 1991?
The strongest piece of evidence that shows what I consider to be the ambiguity between the plan documents, which allow termination, and the VSRP documents, is the calculation worksheet itself. That calculation worksheet is calculated on the basis these people will receive money up to 65, then they'll receive different money thereafter, and upon passing of that particular employee, the benefits go to the wife. Now, I don't know how you can interpret that as meaning anything other than a lifetime benefit. The lifetime of both the wife and the husband, if that election is made. That is totally consistent with the 1990s plan, which gave Continental full authority to vest benefits, which was subsequently changed in 1996 when CNA restated that plan. But the 1990 plan, which was in effect at the time these folks retired, clearly allowed this company to vest benefits if they so sought. So that's the ambiguity. It's what it said here, and then they say in another document that's not associated with the VSRP, oh, we have a right to terminate this benefit. But that kind of reference wasn't put into the VSRP, and it was marketed as a separate, distinct program, a voluntary special retirement program.
Did the VSRP actually create new type of retirement benefits, or did it simply accelerate the eligibility of employees to receive benefits otherwise that were otherwise set forth in the company's general retirement plan?
It accelerated, and it also increased the amount of money that people could get earlier.
So did it create a new type of retirement?
It did not.
That goes back to where I'm saying that after 7 years, everybody was at 62 or older. And wouldn't they be in the same boat?
No, because hopefully we all live to be long beyond our 80s these days, and they would still be entitled to the monthly.
Whereas if they had not retired, they would not be so entitled.
That's correct.
So they had a special deal over and above even people who stayed there and subsequently retired.
Exactly.
My time is up. Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Kramer?
May it please the Court. Boiled down to its essentials, appellants are pursuing nothing more than a claim for benefits under ERISA over CNA's elimination of the retiree health care allowance for all Continental employees. CNA had acquired Continental in 1995. It's undisputed that the retiree health care allowance was part of a health plan at that time that provided, in its health plan documents as well as its summary plan description, that health care benefits could be changed at any time by the company.
Now, that seems to me to be the key issue here, is what do the documents demonstrate? Judge Moran was quite emphatic about that he thought they were quite clear. I'm not sure exactly why I thought that way, but tell me why they're clear. The documents that relate specifically to this program certainly don't say anything about retaining any right to modify the benefits, right?
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. First of all, the VSRP plan itself, with the VSRP materials that were sent out to employees in the fall of 1991, there was a cover letter with a packet of materials.
There's a cover letter, right? I'll grant you that, but did any of the documents that specifically related to the program, other than the cover letter, have any reference to this particular issue?
The cover letter provided the list of documents that employees needed to consider in order to determine whether or not they wanted to retire under the Voluntary Special Retirement Program. One of those was the 1992 Guide for Employees Considering Retirement. Within there, that guide discussed in great detail the health care allowance upon which this issue has come up, and includes within express reservations of rights clauses, indicating the company had the right to change the plan. In addition, that document also indicated that it was based upon the plan, the health care plan itself. Now, the other documents that the opposing counsel has referenced, there was a brief description provided along with this packet as well, and in that brief description it referenced the 1991 summary plan description as well as the 1991 and 1992 guides for employees considering retirement. All three of those documents contained reservations of rights clauses.
Is it true, though, that Mr. Katzman, Continental's former general counsel, said that the VSRP literature should have been drafted differently to warn employees that the HCA could be terminated?
Mr. Katzman testified in his deposition, I believe, if I recall correctly, that he would have done it differently. However, he was testifying about that just a few years ago after this case was already in there. There was no evidence at all that Mr. Katzman had any different ideas back when the plan was put together or made any attempt to suggest that an additional reservation of rights clause should be put in. I would remind the court that this court has found that an employer does not have to put a reservation of rights clause in every single document that it provides to plan participants, as long as it has the reservation of rights clause in the plan document and summary plan description.
But look, if, as the plaintiffs assert, employees were told that the VSRP was a distinct retirement program, then shouldn't the documents, the VSRP documents themselves, have apprised the employees that benefits like the HCA were terminable at Continental's discretion?
I think there are two issues here. As I mentioned earlier, the packet of materials did contain reservations of rights clause in some of the materials, and other materials referenced other documents with reservations of rights clauses.
There wasn't any statement, though, that the VSRP program is subject to all the conditions that apply to the plan in general, is there?
Well, the plan, health care plan document itself is...
I mean, it says we're sending it to you to take a look at it. So, I mean, is there anything that nails this down, makes it legally specific?
Well, I think there are two things. One, as Judge Moran noted, you have to read all these documents as a whole. The documents upon which the appellants wish to rely simply say that there will be a retiree health care allowance, and then the other document they rely on sets forth an amount. It doesn't give any details with regard to the retiree health care allowance, how it's to be paid out, whether or not it can be rolled over, what have you. All that information is contained within the plan documents. The only way to read this is to read this all together. As I indicated also, the plan itself specifically incorporates by reference any written changes to plan benefits. The plan itself provides that the VSRP is part of the health plan. And I would like to point out that
the plan itself certainly doesn't have any specific reference to the VSRP, though.
No, but it does say that from time to time written changes to plan benefits are made and that those are hereby incorporated by reference into the plan itself.
Well, but were they being told that the VSRP was a distinct retirement program?
No. There is no evidence in the record, no sufficient evidence in the record to indicate that. All there is an affidavit from one of the plaintiffs, Ms. Heidemann, where she indicates basically that that was her understanding. There was no sufficient evidence under Rule 56 of anyone ever saying this was a separate and distinct plan. It's certainly not in the documents themselves.
But if she testified, you have the Continental, that Continental Management was instructing the human resource officers and managers to tell these employees that there would be a lifetime HCA, then why wouldn't that support the inference that these weren't just negligent misstatements by lower level employees, but that they were a part of a campaign of misinformation?
Ms. Heidemann testified that she believed at that meeting someone did say that there was a lifetime benefit, at the meeting in New York that you're referring to. At that meeting, however, there's also undisputed testimony in the record from CNA officials saying that there was a discussion over the fact that benefits could be changed and that if need be, benefits would be changed. Moreover, again, you need to, if you recall, even Ms. Heidemann, when she testified, she explained benefits to the employees, acknowledged the fact that she was aware that she was not supposed to encourage employees one way or the other to make a decision, that she was simply to provide facts, that the employees would have to make up their own mind. And that disclaimer is also appears throughout the VSRP documents, advising employees that it is their choice to decide whether or not to accept the VSRP.
Of course, that's why the VSRP program is distinct, I think, from the general retirement program, in that this is a voluntary program, and that the employees have to assent to pursue this program. With the other program is automatic if they become employees, right?
Well, again, I mean, the VSRP plan documents do not say that it is a distinct program, and all it is, and I think this needs to be clear, is what was done with regard to the pension plan and what was done with regards to the retiree health care allowance wasn't to change the benefit. It was simply to eliminate the penalty for people for retiring early at that time. So instead of getting a reduced retiree health care allowance if they retired less than age 62 with less than 25 years of experience, they received the maximum amount. This was not a new benefit per se, as much as a limited time offer for employees if they wanted to retire under the health care plan, not to be doxed for the fact that they didn't have the minimum number of years of service and age to reach the maximum benefit.
Well, is this properly defined, as was questioned earlier, an acceleration of an existing plan?
It was for that limited time, and I don't know if I'd say the word acceleration as much as a waiver of the penalty for people who retired early.
Okay, but you, in effect, are, I don't know what to call it, a younger person is in effect 62. They are, is it 65? Do they get the benefit of someone older by retiring early?
Yes, they did not.
So if they had retired at age 65, would they have gotten the same benefit?
Yes.
And so at age 55, they're able to get what otherwise would require them to wait till they were 65.
Exactly.
On the Fromm case, there wasn't any doubt at all as to what the documents indicated, was there? There was no ambiguity in the written documents, parts of the plan.
Well, the Fromm case did have reservation.
I mean, the issue there was, can that be altered by oral representations made by various employees of the company? But there wasn't any doubt as to what the paper said, was there?
Well, I would submit that there's no doubt in this case either. I mean, the plan documents, when read as a whole, clearly have reservations of rights language in them, and refer the readers to other documents with reservations of rights language in them. But you're right, Fromm was a case involving an employer who made statements that benefits would be for lifetime, and Fromm case specifically held that such statements, when given at the time they were given, and when they were true at the time they were given, cannot constitute some sort of misrepresentation, especially in light of reservation of rights clause.
I mean, I'm not sure why Judge Moran said the Fromm case made our law different from the other circuits, particularly because I was on that panel. I was a little surprised to read that. But I thought the only issue in the Fromm case was the oral versus the written aspect of the problem.
Well, I think Fromm also, though, did address the idea that saying something is a lifetime benefit, whether orally or in writing, as in the Sprague case, there was written comments that it was a lifetime benefit. And in Sprague, which is a Sixth Circuit case, There were written documents saying the benefit was a lifetime benefit that did not specifically have a reservation of rights clause in those particular documents. And as that court noted, as this court has noted, again, you do not have to have a reservation of rights clause in every particular document you provide to employees for the reservation of rights clause to provide, to apply. But the idea, again, with Fromm is that, as you indicated, telling someone that something is a lifetime benefit is not a misstatement if it is true at the time it is made. With regards to the plan itself, Judge Moran properly determined that the plan documents, under either an arbitrary or capricious standard of review or a de novo standard of review, clearly and unambiguously do not vest employee health care allowance benefits. And he did this, as I indicated again, by looking at all the plan documents as a whole, which this court has acknowledged is something that needs to be done when reviewing plan documents. Nowhere in those plan documents does it expressly vest retiree health care benefits. Moreover, those documents do contain...
Well, assuming it doesn't vest, I mean, it doesn't clearly vest is that really the issue here, or is ambiguity, if we're going to pursue the question of the breach of fiduciary duty, is there ambiguity enough to qualify for under that rubric?
Well, with regards to the breach of fiduciary duty, and again, I mean, the court in Fromm, I believe this case is directly on point with Fromm. Again, the statement that a plan is a lifetime benefit is not, in and of itself, a misstatement. And here, again, there was no conspiracy to somehow deprive employees of their benefits, and I think that was clear in opposing counsel acknowledged.
Well, Fromm has got some language about it. You know, if you train all the people that are going to talk to the employees properly, that ought to satisfy their requirements. But that doesn't seem to have been the case here, is it?
Well, I don't believe the record has much of any evidence with regards to the training of employees. But again, in Fromm, and for that matter, in Verity, the case this all relies upon, in Verity there was an intentional scheme to defraud employees of plan benefits.
Well, this case doesn't rise to the Verity standard, I don't think, but I don't know that Fromm says you have to comply, it has to be as bad as Verity to qualify as a breach of fiduciary duty.
But this situation is nowhere close to Verity. In fact, it is directly on line with Fromm. And in Fromm, the court recognized that the Fromm situation was worlds apart from Verity. There is no evidence here. This retirement plan was offered, voluntary special retirement plan was offered back in 1991. It was 3-4 years later before CNA even purchased the company. And again, 1998, before any decision was made, and any evidence in the record is made that any decision was made to eliminate these plan benefits. There was no scheme or anything like that. At best, people did say that it was a lifetime benefit, but again, if this court has held that alone, if it was true at the time, is not a misrepresentation. It does not rise to the level of a breach of fiduciary duty, especially whereas here, there were sufficient plan documents that contained reservations of rights clauses.
Mr. Kramer, I'm kind of interested in why you think it was improper for Judge Moran to allow discovery on the breach of fiduciary duty claim, because, well, I mean, is that really the type of claim that we could just decide on the administrative record that was before the plan administrator?
I believe the court can, and I believe that the court should. As you are aware, in the Seventh Circuit under Perlman, if the arbitrary and capricious standard is applied, the court should be limited to the administrative record below. Now, Perlman admittedly was not a case that involved a breach of fiduciary duty claim, but it seems to me that the principle should still apply. And I would point out to the Verity case itself, where the Supreme Court acknowledged that there were significant concerns that participants would attempt to use a breach of fiduciary duty standard to circumvent claims for benefits, and having the plan administrator adjudicate those claims for benefits, and having that be under an arbitrary and capricious standard of review if the plan so provides.
Well, it sort of seems to me that a breach of fiduciary claim is a broader claim that isn't focused on some plan administrator's construction and application of a plan.
All right, see, my time is up, but if I may answer.
Sure, thanks.
The plan administrator is charged with interpreting the plan. The plan administrator certainly is capable of hearing evidence with regards to whether or not there's been a breach of fiduciary duty and determining whether or not, based upon that, plan benefits should be granted or denied. It does not seem to me that there should be any difference. And in fact, again, in the Verity case, the Supreme Court indicated that the principles of trust law that allow for an arbitrary, capricious standard of review should, I believe, equally apply to this type of situation.
Yeah, otherwise, the authority for that?
Yeah, I'd love to hear the authority.
We're reviewing a decision of the administrator when we apply a breach of fiduciary duty?
Well, again, Your Honor, the Supreme Court, and I apologize, did not specifically say that, but when discussing the concerns about the dichotomy between people able to bring fiduciary duty claims and being able to bring claims for benefits under the same thing, did acknowledge the fact that the rules, principles of trust apply the same thing. And if you give me one second here,
I mean, but just think about it even common sense-wise. If ever you want to know the facts of the situation, wouldn't that be it?
Yes, but why shouldn't a plan participant be required to provide those facts to the plan administrator when he provides the rest of the facts to his claim? And the page I'm referring to in the Verity case is page 513, where there was a concern about repackaging claims. And I would request the court to take a look at that and see and consider, because again, these type of claims, especially if you're going on some sort of strict liability standards, I believe that the opposing counsel is trying to argue, is simply going to open the way for participants to bring all sorts of claims and circumvent the plan appeal procedures that are in the plan documents and the plan appeal procedures that this court, the Supreme Court, has indicated should be followed when considering claims for benefits. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Steckenberg? You've got about a minute. You stretch that out.
I've practiced law for 30 years and I never done anything in a minute.
No. It's because the yellow light's on, so you don't have to worry about it.
I think the only thing I want to say is this program was sold to these retirees as a package. It wasn't sold, here you got all these accelerated pension rights, and oh, incidentally, here's the HCA, and oh yeah, we can terminate that. Okay, it was sold as a package. And if you look at those pension benefits, those will go as long as these folks are alive. Okay, wouldn't it be reasonable for anybody who sold this package to believe that the HCA would also be part of that package? And for this employer not to put in the HCA documentation a specific reference that they had the right to terminate is not negligence, it's deliberate, intentional misinformation. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. That case will be taken under advisement.